Welcome to the Educational Brew Podcast with me, Howell Roberts. So, what is the Educational Brew Podcast? Well, basically, every so often I'm going to sit down and have a cup of tea with an educational guest. This week it's the turn of Dave Whittaker. More about him in a minute. If you want to get in touch, you can email me on brewpod@yahoo.co.uk or you can tweet at Education Brew. So I'll look forward to hearing from you and I hope you enjoy the podcast. So I'd like to welcome this afternoon Dave Whittaker, Executive Principal of Springwell Community Special School in Barnsley, who's given up his time just to have a chat and basically contribute to this first podcast. So thanks very much for your time, Dave.
Pleasure.
And I just wondered if you could just start us off, really. Just tell us about your school. It says it's a special school. What does that mean?
Springwell's an EBD special school, and it's an 80-place special school cross-phase. So we have children from Key Stage 1 all the way through to Key Stage 4. So we're dealing with the youngest children at 4 years old all the way up to year 11. But we've also got a franchise with Barnsley College, which allows us to take post-16 students. So we actually are working with students who are 17 and 18 years old as well. And all of those children in the school are special educational needs pupils with statements to do with their behaviour. So they're very, very challenging kids who can't be in any mainstream schools, and they come to us, they're referred to us by the local authority, and we become their school. So
when a school kicks out a kid, let's say I'm in a mainstream secondary school, we exclude a kid, we've had enough of him, he comes to you?
Not necessarily. He or she would more than likely go to a PRU, a pupil referral unit. And in this case, that's not Springwell. However, Springwell School is commissioned by the local authority to run the pupil referral units as well. So we do have what is known as Barnsley PRU, which is a pupil referral unit cross-phase again, Key Stage 1, 2, 3 and 4. And so we do look after those pupils as well. But there are the two distinct cohorts, and people sometimes get them mixed up. Your pupil referral unit children are the ones that you just mentioned, the children that get kicked out, the children that are excluded or are at risk of exclusion. The special school pupils are pupils with diagnosed conditions, genuine SEN pupils, pupils that are, for example, have ADHD, autistic spectrum disorder, Tourette's, oppositional defiance disorder, that sort of thing. So we deal with them in a different way than what we would with a pupil referral unit. Sounds complicated, but it's not, because essentially what we're dealing with is behaviours, and seriously challenging behaviours, but in two different formats.
So is this a model that a lot of authorities might use up and down the country, or is it quite unique to the setup that you've got? Is it unique?
Fairly unique, but as it happens, quite a lot of local authorities are coming to visit us in Barnsley and looking at the setup and how that works, because it's just a logical way to do things. For example, we have primary children in our primary phase in the special school that are pupil referral unit children, but quite a lot of the pupil referral unit children at 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old are pre-diagnosis SEN children. So they might be from broken homes, from dysfunctional families where the support mechanisms haven't been in place. And so the children get referred out of school for behaviour, and it turns out that they're autistic. So we're able to put in place assessment and intervention, and sometimes that leads to statementing. And so the children can then go from a pupil referral unit setting seamlessly into a special school setting, where they will receive a special school education for the rest of their school careers, which works really, really well. Also, the economies of scale of looking after both pupil referral units and a special school means that what we have got is that wraparound curriculum, the additionality that you might have with challenging children. Economies of scale allows us to have a therapeutic intervention, for example, with pupil referral unit children. It allows us to have parent support advisors, a counselling team, education welfare service, all that work across both the special school and the PRUs, which allows us to just give more to the PRU setting than what may normally not be there.
So as the principal of this organisation, are you basically organising all those different groups and different professional teams? Are you sort of like responsible for all those?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a fairly big leadership team for the size of the organisation, because essentially what we've got is 80 children in a pupil in a special school setting, and then another 100 in a pupil referral unit setting. So we've got a lot of chaotic kids and a lot of really challenging kids. I think to sort of give it some context, if you were to take a normal mainstream secondary that might have a handful of really challenging children, well, basically what we've got is every single child in the whole of the setting is one of those children. So what we've got is chaotic children, very, very complex needs and very, very vulnerable. And they need a lot of support, a lot of guidance, and they need some really, really sort of highly skilled professionals looking after them.
Can I pull back just a minute? Because one of the things that we want to do on the podcast is sort of find out a bit about who the people are and how you got to the positions that you're in as well. So thinking of obviously yourself today, you didn't do, I assume you did a PGCE of some description. Are you doing the job that you've always wanted to do, or is this something that you've fallen into?
Fallen into it in a way, but when I did my PGCE in geography at Sheffield University.
Geography, but it took you about half an hour to get here.
It's been a long time since I've drawn an oxbow lake on a blackboard. However, I used to be pretty good at them.
Yeah.
And I used to draw them on one of those blackboards that used to spin round. So once you'd drawn your oxbow lake once, you could leave it there all day and you could surprise the kids by spinning round the blackboard, and there it was, the oxbow lake, ready for everybody to copy.
Yeah, and then you could test them on it next lesson, couldn't you? You could get them to draw it without looking at it.
Yeah, and then the extension activity would obviously be to just copy a little bit out of the book about oxbow lakes.
And for your true G&T, it was colour it in.
They were special.
Why can't we go back to those days?
Yeah.
Sorry, you were saying.
Where were we?
You were a geographer.
I was, yeah, once upon a time. But I remember taking a really challenging group of kids out on a field trip when I was doing my PGCE, and my tutor was there from Sheffield University, and she actually said to me after I'd done this field trip activity with them, she says, "I reckon you're going to end up working with challenging kids when you become a teacher." And she said, "There's a chance you'll end up working in a special school or in a PRU." And that was about sort of 6 months into my PGCE year. And then basically from working in mainstream secondary, working up through SEN and working in inclusion, working with challenging children in alternative provision and learning support units, found myself as a deputy head in a special school, and then from there obviously headship followed.
And what is the leap from mainstream to special setting? How different is it in special setting? Because I mean, I think, and I was a mainstream teacher for a long time, and my view of special setting was a place where kids went perhaps to be amused and be kept inside a building. It would be a tough thing to do, I imagine that, but I'm sure I've heard you say it before, talking about the sort of playing pool and snooker curriculum.
Yeah.
I think
there's been a popular misconception over the years that particularly PRUs, not necessarily special schools, but PRUs have been the places where not only did the children go to die, but also the staff. And I think that's been a real problem with image for us, because it's a case of, let's kick the kids out of sight, out of mind. It's okay for them to play pool and Monopoly, and it's okay for them to mess around and tell everybody to F off. But actually, it's not like that at all. In fact, to be successful as a teacher in a PRU, for example, I think you probably have to be more skilled than in any other setting. I know from my own experience that when teachers go into teaching, or even when they're established as experienced teachers, one of their biggest fears is around behaviour management. Now, if you were to take that expertise and experience of a mainstream setting and move it into a PRU, not only have you got to teach exactly the same things as you might do in a mainstream, you've also got to deal with really, really challenging behaviour. But you've got to do it in a different way. And the reason you have to do it in a different way is because local authorities have a duty to educate everybody, part of the Education Act, which means that essentially children can do whatever they like, whenever they like, and they have still a legal obligation for a local authority to educate them. Now, a lot of those children who have challenges end up in PRUs. When they're in PRUs, you can't kick them out. You can't send them anywhere else. So what you've got to do is you've got to be massively innovative and massively creative about what you do with these kids, because if they do something and they break a rule, there is never the end of the line. And I think this is what people sort of fail to understand, that there is nowhere to go after a PRU unless children are essentially locked up in some sort of secure unit. So what we have to do is we have to just make sure that we provide them with a means to be educated. So really, I suppose in a nutshell, that means is that most schools will have a menu, a list the pastoral team or the head teacher or whoever it might be works their way down. And then when they get to the bottom of the list, there's a serious conversation to be had with that child and their parent. And basically, the conversation is, I'm sorry, but we've reached the end of the line. You're going to have to go. We're going to exclude you. Well, what we do is we work to the end of the list. And when we get to the end of our list, we then have to sit down and say, how can we make this list longer? And what do we do to put on the bottom of the list? Because this kid's got to the bottom of the list, so we need to now make the list longer. What can we do? The massive difference between, for me, between mainstream and special stroke proves is that we do a lot of crisis management. What that doesn't mean is that we're all in crisis as a school. What it is the children and their families have lots of crises which we have to deal with. And I did my MPQH in a mainstream school and did a lot of shadowing of the head, and I learnt a lot from that. However, there wasn't the crisis management in a mainstream school that there is in Pru or special, because there's always a serious issue to solve, and it's a really serious issue, and I think that's something that people don't experience until they're actually in the thick of it and they realise just how difficult these children are. And a lot of it is not to do with the children themselves, it's the issues and that they bring with them and the vulnerabilities that they bring with them to school from their communities and from their families and from their peers that are outside.
That's great, thank you. I think it's time for a brew. Do you want sugar?
It's about time I had a brew. I've been sitting here without a brew, folks, thinking you thought we were having a brew, you haven't even made me a brew yet.
I'm going to go and put kettle on. Is that all right for you, that brew?
It's a lovely brew, actually, to be fair. Good. And it's about time.
Good. Well, enjoy it, because I want you to... You might not get a chance to drink it now, because this is the problem with the whole concept of educational brew.
It's okay. I like it to be tepid.
Yeah, that's good. Well, that's good round here. Okay, so let's have a think about leadership then. Since you stepped into leadership, what would you say you've learned? And I'm sure you've learned a lot, but how could you sum it up?
Loads. I think you learn something every day, and that's just not a cliche at all. That is really what it's like, because there's always a new challenge that comes your way. But I think as far as the big picture's concerned, I think one of the things that really dawned on me was that you have these values, and you have your own personal values. And one of the hardest things is you've got to convert those values into the values of an organisation to start with. But then once you've converted the values into the values of an organisation, you've got to make sure that organisation has the capacity to see those values through.
So, if I'm hearing you right there, Dave, you've got to bring, you're bringing your values to a culture that's perhaps already established as a new head teacher. That must be an enormously challenging thing to do. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, I think that's just an inevitable part of leadership, particularly headship, because what you do is you lead from your own personal values. And if those values don't exist in a school, then you have to bring them to the school and then work at make sure that those values get embedded. I think one of the problems that there is in some schools is that the values are sound, but they're not backed up with the mechanisms to make sure that those values can be seen through, as I said before. For example, you may have a mainstream school, let's say, with a very inclusive set of values, a vision, values, call them what you like, that talk about tolerance, kindness, inclusion, etc., etc. But then what happens is a child commits a dirty deed or a misdemeanour and gets excluded because the mechanism isn't in place to back up the values of inclusion. So what I'm really saying is that for me, we have one underpinning value at Springwell, which is unconditional positive regard. And that is what it is, unconditional positive regard. And the staff have to buy into that, and they have to buy into it on a day-to-day basis. Not just on a day-to-day basis, almost on a minute-by-minute basis, because they have to show the children unconditional positive regard, full stop. Now, in my school, unconditional positive regard genuinely means that. It really does mean that you can get a chair thrown at you one day by a child, but the next day you're teaching them maths with a smile on your face and showing them massive unconditional positive regard. I'm not too sure whether that exists in other places or how widespread that is. I'm not too sure how staff in some schools would respond to the concept of unconditional positive regard. And I think that values are all well and good, and they are, and you need them, but they're no good if you can't see them through. So how do you see them through? You know,
I was going to ask you that. Let's say I'm a new head teacher. I've got a really strong moral purpose. I've read lots of books about leadership. I want to go and make a difference. I get up every morning wanting to make a difference, and I want my staff to feel the same. So, what are the steps that I take to try and bring those values to the centre of what we do in the school?
I think a great starting point is to understand your children. And I think you have to understand the children, you have to understand that the pressures that they're under, you have to understand the baggage that they bring to school every single day. You've got to understand possibly a little bit about child development and how child development fits into the way that children behave. And I'm not just talking about challenging behaviour, I'm talking about all aspects of behaviour. I think as a head teacher with an inclusive ethos, please don't say you've got an inclusive ethos if you then exclude children left, right and centre for the smallest of misdemeanours. It sounds quite controversial, but something's got to be done, and something's got to be done generally across the education system, because we haven't got enough PRU places, we haven't got enough special school places, and the pressures on resourcing at the moment, resourcing EBD special schools, my school's got 80 places and it's full. If I said to the local authority next week, we've got another 50 places available, then they would fill those 50 places, because schools would put their hands up and say, please take these 50 children. I have 100 places available in the pupil referral units, and it's October now, and 85 of those places are full already. Now, where do we go? Where do we go from here when it comes to children who can't be in mainstream education? Well, there's two schools of thought. We either build a bigger boat and we make more space, or what we do is we work with the mainstream schools to be more inclusive and make sure that they're providing more of an appropriate education for everybody and dealing with those challenges in mainstream schools, so that it only comes to a point where when a child genuinely needs to move on, it's because they really have come to the bottom of the list, and by moving on, they're going to get a more appropriate education that's genuinely not available elsewhere.
Nice one. I mean, if I could just go back and ask you about unconditional positive regard, because I'm quite taken with the idea, and I can perhaps see how it works in your setting, but for a mainstream teacher, I can see it seeming quite woolly, really. Are you saying, or does the concept suggest that a child can tell me to F off on a Monday and then on Tuesday I've got to be right nice to her? Is that really what it is?
Absolutely not. What it is, I'm going to just use a phrase that that I really, really like. And this phrase came about from some visiting head teachers who came to my school and did an inquiry visit at my school and spent some time in the classrooms looking at the children and the relationships that between the children and the staff. And the phrase that came out of it was, the staff really, really care about the children, and the children know that the staff really, really care about them. And from that we got this term authentic care, and that sits nicely with unconditional positive regard. But what it means is that relationships underpin everything that we do, absolutely everything that we do. But to back that up, what you've got to do as well is deal with really, really challenging behaviour. And what we don't do is let kids do what they want when they want, and we don't let challenging behaviour go. What we do is deal with absolutely everything, but we deal with it in a way where the aim is to change the behaviour so that the behaviour is less likely to happen again, rather than punish the behaviour and hope it doesn't happen again. And there's a really big difference, because what we aren't is sanctions driven. In fact, I can't stand the term sanctions. What we do is, if we have lots of consequences, the children have to face the consequences of every single action that they might do. It's just not driven by a sanction. Which means that we are a school that use restorative approaches. And restorative approaches are really, really simple. What we do is we change the behaviour and make it less likely to happen again by repairing damage rather than just punishing behaviour.
I'm familiar with the restorative practice, but I've seen it also. I think I'm right in saying it's not always done well in some settings, and that it can be seen as just basically a kid commits a misdemeanour, and what happens with them is they're taken to one side, given a cup of tea and a biscuit, maybe a few questions about what they've done, then they're allowed back into class. And I think for the mainstream teacher, I'm just asking you to see it from a mainstream point of view and see if these concepts will work in mainstream, because, you know, we've talked earlier about perhaps, you know, PRU settings and special schools need to work closer together with mainstreams, otherwise the system can't cope. I teach 21 periods a week, say, how can you sell me the concept of restorative practice? Because someone's been on a course about it, come and shared it at a staff meeting. As far as I can see, I've got to just be really nice to the kid who doesn't, in my eyes, deserve it.
It's dead straightforward. What you've got is you've got an approach to behaviour management, and you choose. You either punish the child or you work with the child to make sure that they have got to be accepting of what they've done, do something about it, and then move on. And that's your two schools of thought. Now, you go into a mainstream school and you ask to have a look at their register for detentions, and you'll see the same names cropping up week in, week out on the detention list, to the point where you get children who just accept detention as part of their week because they know they're never going to bring a pen. So therefore, they'll just take the detention. Can't be bothered to bring a pen. What I'm saying is, wouldn't it not be better to work with that child to find out why they aren't bringing a pen, work with them so that they do bring a pen, and so that they learn that there is a responsibility in life to bring a pen. So therefore, they then don't have to go to detention, and they can get their work done. Now, I know that sounds really, really simple, but essentially that's what we're talking about. And when we're talking about a restorative approach, we're not talking about formal restorative justice. We're not talking about a child going having a nice cup of tea and a biscuit with a deputy head because they're being kicked out of a class. We're talking about a child getting kicked out of a class and having a serious, reflective conversation, the consequences that they're under pressure and they're reflecting, they reflect on their own behaviour and how that's impacted on others. And they also think about how they could be able to put that right or make things better in the future. Okay, they might then go back into the class with a few crumbs down the shirt, but actually what they've done is the consequence of that action that they've taken and that restorative conversation that they've had is far more serious than sitting tapping a table for 20 minutes in detention and building up feelings of revenge that they're going to take against the teacher who put them in detention in the first place. So it is a controversial issue. But actually, every time you kick a kid out, somebody else has to deal with that kid. And whether that's a child that's kicked out of a maths class in a mainstream school, or a child that comes to the end of the line in the school and ends up being permanently excluded, somebody else has to deal with that child somewhere along the line. So ultimately, somebody has to take responsibility. And as much responsibility as possible needs to be taken in the classroom. Now, that doesn't mean excusing poor behaviour, and it never did mean excusing poor behaviour. It means quite the opposite. Deal with it and challenge it and make it happen and put things right, rather than just passing the book and sending it to somebody else.
The way I understand unconditional positive regard, and it's a really hard thing, I think, this is. But the way I describe it is it's the professional capacity to forgive a child. Would that be fair?
It is, to a point, yeah, it is. What you've got to do is you've got to make sure that child trusts you. And if you're being very judgmental all the time, or if you as an adult hold a grudge, then that child will never trust you.
There's a lot of tension, isn't there, in education, it seems, at the moment. There's everything going on, obviously, politically, as there always is. You know, it doesn't matter who's in charge. Teachers and children and education are often played around with. And I just wondered how that big picture, if you like, the big bubble of education, how does that affect you day to day?
I think you've got to be massively aware of the big picture, and I think we're in a very difficult time at the moment because everything's moving so fast. And I think head teachers across the land would agree that it's not necessarily about what the change is, it's about how quickly it's happening and how you haven't got the time to respond appropriately, and that's really, really difficult. And I also think there's a tension at the moment with the teaching profession because of government initiatives and because of the union action and striking and things like that. And I think that's a real, real problem for school leaders, because school leaders are always on the edge. They have to find a balance between making sure that their organisation ticks all the right boxes and is correct as far as their accountability measures are concerned. They also, as a school leader, you have to make sure you do right by every single child that comes into your school, and that's really, really important. But then you've also got to bear in mind your staff and the staff's workload. One thing that I do know is that I think it's really, really difficult to maintain an outstanding school, because in order to be outstanding according to the accountability measures that are placed in front of us to say what outstanding is, to be outstanding is a massive demand, a huge demand on every single member of staff in the organisation. And that conflicts with staff well-being. And so what you've got to do is you've got to find that balance between the two. You have to put massive demands on your staff, but at the same time, you have to try to protect them by looking after them. And I think in my school, that becomes particularly important because of the stresses and strains of dealing with really, really vulnerable and challenging children on a day-to-day basis, because they have to have massive resilience. But at the same time as having massive resilience, they've also got to do their day job, which is teaching really, really good or outstanding lessons hour after hour, day after day. And that is really, really difficult. And I massively appreciate that. So what I've got to do is I've got to go to work on a morning with my set of values. I've got to think about the children and every single one of them and their vulnerabilities and their own challenges that they bring. I've got to think about Ofsted, that constant sword of Damocles that hangs over your head as a school leader. But I've also got to be very aware that I don't grind the teachers down. Not just the teachers, the support staff as well, because of the environment that they work in. That's really, really difficult.
Well, listen, we've come to the end of the podcast. And the thing is, I've opened about 50 cans of worms with you that I want to explore further. There's lots of questions I've got. And I know that the listeners will have some questions as well. And I just wondered if you'd be up for coming back again.
Yeah, absolutely. No problem. In fact, I think it'd be great to listen to some questions that the listeners have given you.
And if you've got some questions, listeners, if you want to get in touch, you just email in brewpod. brewpod@yahoo.co.uk, or you can tweet direct to the podcast. That's @educationbrew. Send us some questions in for Dave, and we'll let you know. We'll let you know if you follow us on Twitter. We'll let you know that when the podcast's going to happen. Well, thanks very much for taking the time to download this podcast, and we look forward to seeing you next time.